shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free.
The Herald of Truth broadcast is on the air, a program of spirit and truth dedicated to teaching the way of God more perfectly. These broadcasts contain keys to help unlock knowledge and reveal hidden truths of the Bible in these last days. Christians, called to a higher level of understanding, will be given Bible-based solutions to their personal as well as national problems. They will want to find out more about their part in God's plan. Our mailing address is Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas, 72602, and will be given again at the end of this broadcast.
The Babylonians. The largest, most powerful criminal organization in the world is not the Mafia or Cosa Nostra. It is not the drug cartel. It is not the Red Government of Russia or China or Cuba. It isn't even the IRS. These are only a few of the thousands of parts which comprise Mystery Babylon the Great, and which make her so mysterious to the world over which she reigns. To describe any part of Babylon, such as New York City, as all of Babylon, is not to see her at all. It is like the blind men who are asked to describe an elephant. Each one described it according to the part he touched, a snake, a tree trunk, a wall, and so forth. The brain or control center of the Babylonian world system is comprised of the hidden, cabalistic crew of international bankers who own and control the Federal Reserve and the other central banks of the world. They will be referred to hereinafter by their real, true identity, Jews. The lifeblood of this harlot is the wealth of the world stolen through the operations of their central and commercial banks. The political and economic systems of the nations, whether democracies or dictatorships, are not controlled by the people and for the people, but rather by the Jews and for the Jews. The principle by which this power is acquired and maintained was set forth by the founder of the Rothschild dynasty of Jews, Meir Amschel Rothschild, 200 years ago when he said, "Permit me to issue and control a nation's money, and I care not who makes its laws." What this translates to is simply that we now have the best Congress that Jew money can buy. The simple but brilliant scheme to enslave whole nations by controlling their money systems was facilitated by keeping the people ignorant about money, the most important thing people must understand in order to be free. As John Adams said in 1787, "All the perplexities, confusion, and distress in America arise not from defects in their constitution or confederation, not from want of honor or virtue, so much as the downright ignorance of the nature of coin, credit, and circulation." This is exactly the situation which exists today in America. Those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it. Of course, we cannot be expected to remember the past if we do not know the past. Therefore, one of the first objectives of the Jews was to gain control of our education system. This was accomplished simply by obtaining controlling interest in the companies that publish our high school and college textbooks on history and economics. As a consequence, the knowledge necessary for us to be economically and politically free has been kept from us, and our nation is being rapidly gobbled up by the Jews. This situation was prophesied by Thomas Jefferson, author of the Declaration of Independence, when he said, "If the American people ever allow private banks to control the issue of their currency, first by inflation and then by deflation, the banks and corporations that will grow up around them will deprive the people of all property until their children will wake up homeless on the continent their fathers conquered." Jefferson, along with Benjamin Franklin and James Madison, adamantly opposed the plans of the New York Jew agent Alexander Hamilton to establish a private central bank for the United States like the Bank of England. However, after Franklin's death in 1790, Hamilton succeeded in bribing enough congressmen to have Congress grant a charter to the Jews in 1791 for the first bank of the United States for a period of 20 years. Having lost his battle against the Jews, Jefferson said, "I believe that banking institutions are more dangerous to our liberties than standing armies. Already they have raised up a money aristocracy that has set the government at defiance. The issuing power of money should be taken from the banks and restored to Congress and to the people to whom it belongs." When the charter expired in 1811, a wiser or more honest Congress refused to renew it. What followed was the War of 1812 in an effort to reestablish the rule of the Bank of England over us, as was the case before our War of Independence. Here's how the scam works. Now, you may be shocked at hearing such seemingly incredible claims, but they only seem incredible because these details about the real causes of historical events were carefully omitted from our history books. There is far more to the story, and much worse, but to gain a comprehensive understanding of how this criminal system developed requires an overview of history, which, even though greatly condensed, is quite lengthy. Therefore, we will interrupt the historical narrative to provide an explanation of the mechanics of how the criminal scam called fractional reserve banking works to enslave the people caught in its insidious trap. In the first place, most Americans believe that our government creates our money in accordance with Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution, which states, "The Congress shall have power to coin money, regulate the value thereof, and of foreign coin." This most important power of government was again surrendered by Congress in 1913 to a private corporation called the Federal Reserve. It is no more federal than Federal Express, and is no more a reserve than a bucket without a bottom. Yet more than 9 out of 10 Americans ignorantly believe that it is a government agency. The actual owners of the Federal Reserve will be named later. The process by which the Jews conquer nations economically is simply unbelievable because it is unbelievably simple. Here's how it works. First, they seduce the political authority to grant them monopoly power to issue the nation's money as debt at interest, or usury. Second, they create the money OTA out of thin air as a book or computer entry when they loan this bank credit to the government and corporations in exchange for interest-bearing bonds and to individuals in exchange for title to their property. Third, when there is no unencumbered property remaining to collateralize more loans and there is insufficient money to repay the loans, the victims are foreclosed. The reason that the sequence is inevitable is the best-kept economic secret in the world. Here it is. When the Jews and their associates, your friendly local banker, create the money as a bookkeeping entry to make a loan, say $1,000 for 1 year, the interest, usury, on that loan, say 10% or $100, is not created and therefore cannot be paid. When the bank credit is put into circulation, it increases the money supply and generates increased economic activity throughout the society. When the principal is repaid, the bank credit is eliminated and economic activity is reduced accordingly. If it stopped there, we could have an honest and potentially stable money system. But then comes the rub. Since the interest amount was not created, it remains in the economy as a bank claim on someone's property. Why? Because in order to pay the $100 interest, which was not created, on the first loan, someone had to borrow it into circulation. Thus, an unending cycle of debt is instituted with the inevitable eventual result being that title to all real wealth in the nation is owned by the Jews. This is the reason why our farms, homes, and factories are being foreclosed by the thousands every week. It is also the real reason for inflation, which has reduced the dollar to about 10% of its value in 1940. All of our money, except for our coins and the few remaining U.S. notes, has been borrowed out of thin air into circulation as debt. About 95% of this debt exists as bank deposits, checkbook money, and about 5% exists as Federal Reserve notes. There is not enough money in circulation, called M1, to pay the $3 trillion plus national debt let alone the $7 trillion plus private debt. Talk about balancing the federal budget is just that. Talk. If the federal government, under this criminal Babylonian money system, did not continually borrow more Federal Reserve Bank credit into circulation, we would have no medium of exchange. Furthermore, this debt exceeds the value of all the real estate in America, which is pledged to pay it. Therefore, we are now legally bankrupt. In the words of Robert Hemphill, for many years credit manager of the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta, quote, if all bank loans were paid, no one would have a bank deposit, and there would not be a dollar of currency in circulation. This is a staggering thought. We are completely dependent on the commercial banks. Someone has to borrow every dollar we have in circulation, cash or credit. If the banks create ample synthetic money, we are prosperous. If not, we starve. We are absolutely without a permanent money system. When one gets a complete grasp upon the picture, the tragic absurdity of our hopeless position is almost incredible. If the money problem is the most important subject intelligent persons can investigate and reflect upon, it is so important that our present civilization may collapse unless it is widely understood and the defects remedied soon, end of quote. The enormous criminal power of the Fed was exposed by Louis T. McFadden, chairman of the House Committee on Banking and Currency in 1933, before the Jews finally succeeded in murdering him after two unsuccessful attempts. He wrote, quote, every effort has been made by the Federal Reserve Board to conceal its powers. But the truth is, the Fed has usurped the government. It controls everything here, Congress, and it controls all our foreign relations. It makes and breaks governments at will. Hopefully you now have the picture and understand the mechanics of how this criminal money system works. However, in case someone doesn't comprehend the scam, let's have an object lesson. Probably everyone is familiar with the game of Monopoly, which has a very appropriate name. However, its rules are those of a make-believe world. But with a few simple rule changes, we can make it resemble the real economic world. First, count all the money available. For example, $8,000. Second, loan, not give, an amount, $2,000, to each of our four players. Third, instead of each player collecting $200 from the bank every time he passes go, he pays $200 interest to the bank. Now you should know who will win every game. If not, play it according to these rules and find out. But then perhaps you, along with thousands of other Americans every week, have already lost the real-life game and know who the winner is. The Jews. Always. If you learn nothing else from this dissertation, learn this. If you are in debt, you are not free. You are a bond slave. Even if you have no personal debt as a U.S. citizen, your share of the national debt is over $20,000, and whatever property you think you own is pledged to pay that debt. As the Bible states in Proverbs, the 22nd chapter, the 7th verse, the borrower is servant to the lender. The manner in which bond slaves were to be controlled was put forth in the Banker's Manifest of 1934. Quote, capital must protect itself in every way, through combination and through legislation. Debts must be collected and loans and mortgages foreclosed as soon as possible. When, through a process of law, the common people have lost their homes, they will be more tractable and more easily governed by the strong arm of the law, applied by the central power of wealth under control of leading financiers. People without homes will not quarrel with their leaders. This is well known among our principal men now engaged in forming an imperialism of capital to govern the world. By dividing the people, we can get them to expend their energies in fighting over questions of no importance to us, except as teachers of the common herd. That's what they said way back in 1934, and you're in it now. Did you get that? All other issues take a back seat and are secondary to the question of money. We have been divided into 1,000 different camps, ranging from anti-communist to anti-racist, and neutralized by waiting for the rapture, or boozing with the boob tube. What is your favorite diversion? That is, if you have any time left after working more than 6 months every year for the Jews and their government, it's a safe bet that you don't study history or money, which, to requote Robert Hemphill, is the most important subject intelligent persons can investigate and reflect upon. It is so important that our present civilization may collapse unless it is widely understood and the defects remedied very soon. In order to understand how the Jews acquired their absolute power over the nations, it is necessary to understand some history which has been omitted from our history textbooks. This knowledge is also necessary so that we do not repeat it again. In the beginning, there was no money, and there was no civilization. Every man obtained his own necessities of life, food, shelter, and clothing, through his own efforts. This was probably the only period in history, other than Eden, that man was truly free and independent. However, this was a very difficult, dangerous, and insecure lifestyle. Eventually, they developed a system of exchange of goods and services which we call barter. In this economic system, every man benefited because he would only trade something he had for something that was of greater value to himself. For instance, if Jim had 10 potatoes and Bill had 10 fish, they could trade 5 potatoes for 5 fish, and each would have a complete meal for his family. It was soon realized that by specializing, a man could produce a given commodity much more efficiently and trade his surplus with other specialists to obtain all of his needs. Thus, everyone who efficiently produced something which many people needed or wanted could make a very comfortable living. The value that each man placed on his own produce was primarily a function of the time he spent to produce it, plus what he spent for raw materials and tools. It was soon realized, however, that barter was a very inconvenient system, and fun though it might be, consumed much time in bargaining over the value of commodities. After all, every man values everything differently from every other man and at different times and places. Eventually, the use of certain durable commodities, such as gold and silver, became popular as a medium of exchange and greatly facilitated trade. Civilization began to develop as more men became specialists, and an increasing variety of goods was produced for both production, tools, and consumption. The use of gold and silver bullion as media of exchange, although far superior to trading cows and corn, was still somewhat difficult, because their weight and purity had to be determined. Weighing them was relatively easy with balanced scales, but determining purity was quite difficult. These problems were overcome with the introduction of coins, which were certified by the issuing authority to be of the weight and purity stamped upon them. As wealth increased, one of the trades that developed was that of making gold jewelry, or goldsmithing. Because goldsmiths dealt in large quantities of gold, it was necessary for them to have secure vaults or safes in which to store their valuable commodity for protection from theft. Other people who acquired significant amounts of metallic money, especially merchants and craftsmen, also acquired security for their money. It soon became common practice for them to deposit their money with the goldsmiths for a small fee. In return, the goldsmith would give the depositor a receipt for the amount of the deposit. A depositor could then give his warehouse receipt to a supplier in payment for goods, rather than transferring the metal itself. This method of payment was so convenient and simple that it soon became common practice. Thus was born the business of banking. The shrewd goldsmiths in Babylon soon realized that of all the gold deposited with them, only a small percentage was reclaimed each month with the warehouse receipts they had issued. As wealthy men, they were often asked for loans. As shrewd men, they were soon lending out as much as 90% of the gold placed on deposit with them, typically requiring that 4 talents of gold be returned to them in 1 year for every 3 loaned, an interest rate of 33 1/3%. Since there was a limited amount of gold in circulation, they soon cornered the market on gold and became the richest men in Babylon. Their descendants still are, and are referred to in Revelation's 18th chapter, 23rd verse, "For thy merchants were the great men of the earth, for by thy sorceries," that's pharmacia and drugs, "were all nations deceived. people who are drugged or poisoned with alcohol, nicotine, caffeine, medicine, sugar, chlorine, fluoride, TV, government, education, and religion have short-circuited brains and simply cannot think logically. If you are having difficulty understanding this, hopefully you now understand why. With virtually all of the gold in their possession, the goldsmiths could loan out their warehouse receipts for amounts totaling more than 10 times the amount of gold actually in their vaults and charge interest, usury, on something which had cost them virtually nothing. The clay tablets were very cheap. When this debt money was created and circulated in the society, it caused a temporary increase in trade and the production of real wealth until the loan was repaid. However, when the money was created, the amount of the interest was not created, and the ultimate result was a net reduction of money in circulation, causing depression and foreclosure, unless, of course, more money was loaned into circulation. Thus was born fractional reserve banking and the system of usury which today rules the world. This is the lifeblood of the system identified in Revelation chapter 18 as Mystery Babylon the Great. Occasionally, the people holding these gold certificates would get wise to the fact that the goldsmith did not actually have enough gold on deposit with which to redeem his certificates. This would result in a run on the bank and his sudden demise, unless, of course, he had previously escaped with his hoard of gold. Being shrewd, the goldsmiths recognized this as an unhealthy situation. Therefore, after very little thought, they decided to bring the king in as a partner. After all, the king was always in need of gold to support his concubines and palace guard. Thus, the king was only too happy to provide government sanction and protection for this racket in exchange for greatly discounted interest rates, even lower than the prime rate. But the shrewd goldsmiths thought that government protection might not be sufficient. After all, the police couldn't protect him 24 hours a day, since the king was also God in the combined state religion of Baalism. The Jews decided the safest way for them to practice their black art was under cover of religion. After all, there might be many who would revolt against slavery and risk imprisonment or death. What's the difference? But few religionists, even though enslaved, will challenge, quote, authority, unquote, and risk eternal torment by being excommunicated. Thus, many Jews became Baal priests and practiced their banking scam in the temples with complete safety. Thus was joined the unholy Babylonian trinity of government, religion, and banking, or, for short, GRAB, which rules the world today as a great mystery to the deceived goyim, especially Christians, who are their prime target. The beginning and rise to world dominion of this Babylonian system is detailed in the book of Daniel. The gold standard was established by King Nebuchadnezzar when he erected a monument of gold on the plain of Dura and commanded that everyone bow down and worship it. This was about 500 B.C. when the Israelites from the southern kingdom of Judah were in Babylon as captives. Apparently, all but four of them complied with the king's orders, Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. This is not too surprising, since the Israelites had previously shown a strong proclivity for gold at the very foundation of their nation. When encamped at the foot of Mount Sinai, after being led out of Egyptian slavery, Moses went up to the mountain to receive the law from God. When he returned, the Israelites were worshiping a golden calf. Daniel was given a vision of the Babylonian succession of world powers. The vision was an image of a man with a head of gold, representing Babylon itself, arms of silver representing Medo-Persia, body of brass representing Greece, and legs of iron representing Rome. The feet were of mixed iron and clay. A stone, cut out without hands, was to come out of heaven and destroy this system by striking it in the feet. At the time of the end, after it secretly gained control of the world, therefore becoming mystery, Babylon the Great, the whore that sitteth upon many waters, or nations, committing fornication with the kings of the earth, Revelations the 18th chapter, the 3rd verse. Archaeological searches have uncovered much evidence of Babylon's social and economic systems, which were very similar to ours of today. For instance, the Igibi Bank was found with thousands of clay tablet notes and interest usury bearing contracts, which served as their money. Babylon loaned much money at interest or usury to Persia, which, of course, Persia could not repay. Therefore, Persia conquered Babylon to eliminate its debt and acquire Babylon's gold. Persia adopted the Babylonian usury system and loaned Greece much money at interest or usury. Greece, of course, could not repay the debt and conquered Persia to eliminate its debt and acquire the gold in Persia. Greece adopted the Babylonian usury system and loaned Rome much money at interest, usury. Rome, of course, could not repay the debt and conquered Greece to eliminate its debt and acquire the gold in Greece. After the fall of Imperial Rome, the various nations of Europe were kept in bondage and poverty by the Jews for many centuries, known as the Dark Ages. When the Babylonian civilization collapsed, 3% of the people owned all the wealth. When old Persia went down to destruction, 2% of the people owned all the wealth. When ancient Greece went down to ruin, 0.5% of the people owned all the wealth. When the Roman Empire fell by the wayside, 2,000 people owned the wealth of the civilized world. It is said at this time, less than 2% of the people control 90% of the wealth of America. Guess who they are? No. They're not Aryans, as you see pictured as the Fortune 500 and the old Forbes, the Jew magazine, which tells you who are the richest people in the world. These are the front people. You don't expect them to print in their own Jewish publications that the Rothschilds and the Rockefellers are so rich that you cannot possibly calculate the amount of their fortunes. You couldn't hundreds of years ago, and you can't do it now. One silly sap that puts out a publication in this work, made the statement that the Aryans control the money and that the Jews are only a bunch of pikers and loners. All you have to do is read Forbes magazine and you'll see who the real top millionaires and rich people of the world are. No, you won't, because that magazine is printed by the Jews and they put up these front people to cover for them, the real wealthy people of the world, the multi-millionaires whose fortunes cannot be calculated. Now that you know some history, do you detect a pattern in the affairs of men and nations? Do you begin to understand that wars are created by the Jews, whom Christ called Pharisees and accused them of shedding all of the innocent blood from the time Cain killed Abel? Now you should understand why Christ was crucified only 3 days after he threw the Jewish money changers out of the temple. Now you know why the love of money is the root of all evil. Was there ever a time when men were free of the usurer's yoke of bondage? Yes, and it was a glorious period that lasted for nearly 6 centuries and provided nearly utopian conditions for the working people in England and for shorter periods in the other European nations. This period is known as the Renaissance, but the reason for it is a carefully kept secret. Why? Because the revelation of this knowledge would again result in the banishment of the Jews and a flowering of debt-free freedom. In 1100 A.D., Henry I became king of England and found the treasury empty. The supply of gold and silver coin had mostly gone with the Crusaders to Palestine, and a medium of exchange was urgently required. Rather than seeking loans from Jews, Henry issued into circulation for payment of government debt, or as receipts for goods and services rendered, marked pieces of wood called tallies. These sticks varied in size from about 4 inches long up to 8.5 feet long. The longest represented 50,000 pounds sterling. A pound sterling was originally an actual pound of silver. Notches were cut into the side, the width of the notch representing the value in pounds, and the amount was written on two sides. The sticks were then split and one half paid into circulation, debt-free. They were readily used by the people in trade because they derived their value from the fact that they were receivable in payment of taxes. When the tally was presented for payment of taxes, it had to exactly match, that is, tally, with the half retained in the treasury called the foil. Forgery was nearly impossible. Silver coins continued to circulate also. Usury, or interest as we call it, being strictly prohibited by Scripture, was also prohibited by both the Christian church and government. However, there were those who continued the evil practice until they were banished from England in 1290 A.D. With an honest and convenient money system, an English working man could supply his family's needs for a year by working only 14 weeks. This was the reason that the incredible cathedrals of England and Europe were built completely with volunteer labor. You think that is amazing? What is really amazing is how this information, essential to our freedom, has been so successfully kept concealed from us. This tally money system continued to operate in England until 1783, when it was abolished by statute. Nevertheless, tallies continued to be used in rural areas until 1826. The death knell of the tally system was sounded in 1694, when the king, William of Orange, granted a charter to William Paterson and his Jew associates to establish the Bank of England as a fractional reserve central bank with monopoly power to issue bank notes at interest, usury. This date, 1694, is the most important date in American history, for the Bank of England has had a direct bearing on every major event in America since before our War of Independence. What a disgrace. When the Pilgrims came to America, they did so with an abundance of faith and determination, but a dearth of knowledge concerning economics and human nature. They initially instituted a system of common ownership, or communism. As a result, over half of them died of starvation and disease. Quickly learning their lesson, every man was allotted his own parcel of land on which to grow his own food and build his own home. With little money available, the primary means of exchange was barter. Gradually, some foreign coinage came into the colony and facilitated trade. However, as the economy of Massachusetts quickly grew, due to its hard-working people, natural resources, and free enterprise, the need for a medium of exchange became acute. During this period, there was no official banking system. A few loaning offices were maintained by the colonies, but less than 30 private lending institutions existed in all 13 colonies. Today, they are more numerous than churches. There have been many reasons put forth for the American colonies separating from England, their mother country, and the most powerful nation on earth. Most of these were listed by Thomas Jefferson in the Declaration of Independence. The first two of these read as follows. Quote, he has refused his assent to laws, the most wholesome and necessary for the public good. He has forbidden his governors to pass laws of immediate and pressing importance, unless suspended in their operation till his assent should be obtained. And when so suspended, he has utterly neglected to attend them. What were these most wholesome and necessary laws that were of immediate and pressing importance? Again, a knowledge of true history is necessary to understanding. If you've guessed by now that the Jews were involved, you are absolutely correct. The laws referred to by Jefferson were primarily ones to provide for relief of the economic chaos then existing because of the Bank of England's usury money system that has been imposed on the colonies. Rothschild supplied some of the financing for the war through his agent Haynes Solomon, who operated through Robert Morris. This may seem contradictory to the uninformed, but it is a basic strategy for the Jews to instigate war and finance both sides, especially if it involves Christians killing Christians. The Rothschild fortune began when Meyer Amschel Rothschild provided the Hessian mercenaries for King George to kill American patriots. Having fought and won a bloody war against overwhelming odds, the politicians then surrendered our hard-won freedom to the same cabal of Jews who had brought on the war by granting them a charter for the First Bank of the United States. We were free from their control for a mere 15 years. The Jew agent through whom our slavery was reestablished, Alexander Hamilton, was an Englishman from the West Indies whose real name was Levine. He took the name of his stepfather after his mother divorced and remarried. However, he claimed to be the illegitimate son of Hamilton, which was much more socially acceptable at the time than being a Jew. Hamilton was probably the leading authority on finance and banking at the Constitutional Convention, which, along with his leadership of the New York delegation gave him considerable influence in matters pertaining to money. The constitutional provisions to borrow money on the credit of the United States are the Achilles heel of our Constitution. The original phrase was to borrow money and emit bills on the credit of the United States, which was the same phrase written into the Articles of Confederation by Benjamin Franklin. Thus was the trap set for us to again become slaves of the Jews. Remember, the borrower is servant to the lender. These provisions then enabled Hamilton, especially as Secretary of the Treasury, to lobby for and bribe Congress into granting the charter for the First Bank of the United States in 1791. Thus did America snatch defeat from the jaws of victory and again enter into the debtor's prison owned by the Jews. Alexander Hamilton was a thousandfold more a traitor than was Benedict Arnold, yet Hamilton is revered as a great patriot. Thomas Jefferson understood the Achilles heel of our Constitution. He said, "I wish it were possible to obtain a single amendment to our Constitution. I would be willing to depend on that alone for the reduction of the administration of our government to the genuine principles of its Constitution. I mean an additional article, taking from the federal government the power of borrowing." Returning to the War of 1812, after winning the war, the U.S. was in bad economic condition. But Congress again turned our victory into defeat by chartering the Second Bank of the United States, which was virtually a clone of the First Bank of the United States. When Andrew Jackson became president in 1829, he declared war on the Jews. He told them in scathing words, "You are a den of vipers and thieves, and I intend to rout you out, and by the eternal God, I will rout you out." He vetoed renewing the bank's charter, and in his message to Congress said, "The bold efforts that the present bank has made to control the government, the distress it has wantonly caused, are but premonitions of the fate which awaits the American people, should they be deluded into a perpetuation of this institution or the establishment of another like it. If the people only understood the rank injustice of our money and banking system, there would be a revolution before morning." Jackson removed United States funds from the Second Bank of the U.S. and placed them in state banks. He also eliminated the national debt. It is a sheer miracle that he was not assassinated. The Jews continued their nefarious efforts to establish another central bank without success. Nevertheless, they were able to create confusion and chaos in our money system through the state-chartered banks. However, they despaired of again establishing a central bank through which they could control the entire U.S. Thus was hatched the plot to conquer by dividing the U.S. into two nations. The Jews decided to instigate a war between the North and the South over the slavery issue. The London branch of the Rothschild financed the North, in part, through their agent August Belmont, or Schoenberg, and the Paris branch financed the South through their agents Judah P. Benjamin and John Slidell. However, the Jews, thinking that they had Lincoln at their mercy, overstepped themselves. When the Union requested loans from the private banks to conduct the war, the Jews demanded 28% interest. This angered Lincoln, and he proceeded to give Congress the authority in three issues, a total of $450 million worth of U.S. notes called Lincoln Greenbacks. The London Times, a Jewish paper, editorialized, "If this mischievous financial policy, which has its origin in the North American Republic, shall become indurated down to a fixture, then that government will furnish its own money without cost. It will pay off its debts and be without debt. It will have all the money necessary to carry on its commerce. It will become prosperous without precedent in the history of the world. The brains and the wealth of all countries will go to North America. That government must be destroyed, or it will destroy every monarchy on the globe." They said exactly the same thing in the 1930s about Hitler's Germany. Lincoln said of the Jews, "The money power preys upon the nation in times of peace and conspires against it in times of adversity. It is more despotic than monarchy, more insolent than autocracy, more selfish than bureaucracy. It denounces as public enemies all who question its methods or throw light upon its crimes. I have two great enemies, the Southern Army in front of me and the financial institutions in the rear. Of the two, the one in my rear is my greatest foe." In July 1862, the infamous Hazard Circular was circulated among American bankers by the London Jews. Quote, slavery is likely to be abolished by the war power and chattel slavery destroyed. This I and my European friends are in favor of, for slavery is but the owning of labor and carries with it the care of the laborers. While the European plan, led by England, is that capital shall control labor by controlling wages. This can be done by controlling the money. The great debt that capitalists will see to it is made out of the war must be used as a means to control the volume of money. To accomplish this, the war bonds must be used as a banking basis. We are now waiting for the Secretary of the Treasury to make this recommendation to Congress. End of quote. Salmon P. Chase, Secretary of the Treasury and Congress, succumbed to the pressure of the Jews. The National Bank Act of 1863 was the result. The Jews again gained the power to create our money as debt. Later, Chase repented of his action, saying, my agency is promoting the passage of the National Bank Act was the greatest financial mistake of my life. It has built up a monopoly which affects every interest in the country. It should be repealed, but before that can be accomplished, the people will be arrayed on one side and the bank on the other in a contest such as we have never before seen in this country. End quote. In a letter to the London branch of the Rothschild Bank, Congressman John Sherman of Ohio said, the few who can understand the system will either be so interested in its profits or so dependent on its favors that there will be no opposition from that class, while on the other hand, the great body of people, mentally incapable of comprehending the tremendous advantages that capital derives from the system, will bear its burdens without complaint and perhaps without even suspecting that the system is inimical to their interests. End of quote. Writing about the National Bank Act in 1872, Horace Greeley said, we have stricken the shackles from 4 million human beings and brought all laborers to a common level, not so much by the elevation of the former slaves as practically reducing the whole working population, white and black, to a condition of serfdom. While boasting of our noble deeds, we are careful to conceal the ugly fact that by our iniquitous money system, we have nationalized a system of oppression which, though more refined, is not less cruel than the old system of chattel slavery. End of quote. In order to protect their money monopoly and prevent the expansion of the honest, debt-free money system instituted by Lincoln, he had to be eliminated. And so he was. John Wilkes Booth was a member of the Knights of the Golden Circle, a secret society which was controlled by the Jews, as are virtually all secret societies today. Bismarck, Chancellor of Germany, made the following statement regarding the death of Lincoln. Quote, the death of Lincoln was a disaster for Christendom. There was no man in the United States great enough to wear his boots, and the Jews went anew to grab the riches of the world. I fear that foreign bankers, with their craftiness and torturous tricks, will entirely control the exuberant riches of America and use it to systematically corrupt modern civilization. They will not hesitate to plunge the whole of Christendom into wars and chaos in order that the earth should become their inheritance. Bismarck was right. In order to generate popular support for banking reform, the Jews created the Panic of 1907. Congressman Charles Lindbergh Sr. said, quote, the money trust caused the 1907 panic and thereby forced Congress to create a National Monetary Commission. Senator Nelson Aldrich was named as chairman, thus assigning the fox to guard the henhouse. After 2 years of high living in Europe, at taxpayers' expense, studying the European banking systems, the commission is returned to the United States. Aldrich was grandfather of the Rockefeller brothers. Another member of this commission was Jacob Schiff of Kuhn-Loeb and Company, who had helped to finance the bloody Bolshevik Revolution in Russia to the tune of $20 million. Schiff was born in the house which his family shared with the Rothschilds in Frankfurt, Germany. Immediately after the commission returned from Europe, Aldrich called a secret meeting of Rothschild agents. These men met on November 22, 1910, at the Hoboken, New Jersey railway station and boarded Aldrich's private parlor car with shades drawn. Their destination? the private hunting club of J.P. Morgan and Associates at Jekyll Island, Georgia. Their mission? To draft a document that would undermine the Constitution of the United States and enable the Jews to become the absolute masters of America. The chief architect of this plan was Paul Warburg of Kuhn, Loeb & Company, who was sent from Frankfurt, Germany to accomplish this task as a Rothschild agent. His salary was $500,000 per year, way back then. We will not detail the provisions of the Federal Reserve Act. Suffice it to say that Congress had no authority whatsoever to turn its power to issue our money over to a private corporation, especially one whose Class A stock is owned primarily by alien Jews. Nevertheless, they did so, with large majorities of those voting in both houses violating their oaths of office. The Federal Reserve was established by the Owen-Glass Bill when it was passed by the Senate 43-25 on December 22, 1913, and the House of Representatives 209-60 on December 23, 1913. It was immediately signed into law by President Woodrow Wilson. It has since been called the Federal Reserve Act, and the private central bank which it established is called simply the Fed. When the bill passed, Congressman Charles Lindbergh said, "This Federal Reserve Act established the most gigantic trust on earth. When the president signs this bill, the invisible government of the monetary power will be legalized." The lengths to which the Jews went to ensure passage of their treason act knew no bounds. For instance, to ensure that their agent Woodrow Wilson would become president, they financed Teddy Roosevelt and his Bull Moose Party to split the Republican Party and defeat Taft. 20 years later, Congressman McFadden said, "The sack of the United States by the Federal Reserve is the greatest crime in history." Indeed, it was and is. Congressman McFadden, as chairman of the House Banking and Currency Committee for over 10 years, was the foremost congressional authority on the Federal Reserve and fearlessly exposed their criminal activities. But his efforts to destroy the Fed could not overcome the power of the Jews. However, his warnings are even more pertinent today than when he spoke in the 1930s. Speaking to Congress, he said, quote, "Mr. Chairman, we have in this country one of the most corrupt institutions the world has ever known. I refer to the Federal Reserve Banks, hereinafter called the Fed. The Fed has cheated the government of these United States and the people of the United States out of enough money to pay the nation's debt. The depredations and iniquities of the Fed has cost this country enough money to pay the national debt several times over. This evil institution was impoverished and ruined the people of these United States, has bankrupted itself, and has practically bankrupted our government. It has done this through the defects of the law under which it operates, through the maladministration of that law by the Fed, and through the corrupt practices of the moneyed vultures who control it. Some people think that the Federal Reserve Banks are United States government institutions. They are not government institutions. They are private monopolies which prey upon the people of these United States for the benefit of themselves and their foreign customers, foreign and domestic speculators and swindlers, and rich and predatory money lenders. In that dark crew of financial pirates, there are those who could cut a man's throat to get a dollar out of his pocket. There are those who send money into states to buy votes to control our legislatures. There are those who maintain international propaganda for the purpose of deceiving us into granting of new concessions which will permit them to cover up their past misdeeds and set again in motion their gigantic train of crime. These 12 private credit monopolies were deceitfully and disloyally foisted upon this country by the bankers who came here from Europe and repaid us our hospitality by undermining our American institutions. Those bankers took money out of this country to finance Japan in a war against Russia. They created a reign of terror in Russia with our money in order to help that war along. They instigated the separate peace between Germany and Russia and thus drove a wedge between the Allies in the World War. They financed Trotsky's passage from New York to Russia so that he might assist in the destruction of the Russian Empire. They fomented and instigated the Russian Revolution and placed a large fund of American dollars at Trotsky's disposal in one of their branch banks in Sweden so that through him, Russian homes might be thoroughly broken up and Russian children flung far and wide from their natural protectors. They have since begun breaking up of American homes and a dispersal of American children. Mr. Chairman, there should be no partisanship in matters concerning banking and currency affairs in this country, and I do not speak with any. In 1912, the National Monetary Association, under the chairmanship of the late Senator Nelson W. Aldrich, made a report and presented a vicious bill called the National Reserve Association Bill. This bill is usually spoken of as the Aldrich Bill. Senator Aldrich did not write the Aldrich Bill. He was the tool, if not the accomplice, of the European bankers who for nearly 20 years had been scheming to set up a central bank in the country and who in 1912 had spent and were continuing to spend vast sums of money to accomplish their purpose. We were opposed to the Aldrich plan for a central bank. The men who ruled the Democratic Party then promised the people that if they were returned to power, there would be no central bank established here while they held the reins of government. 13 months later, that promise was broken, and the Wilson administration, under the tutelage of those sinister Wall Street figures who stood behind Colonel House, established here in our free country the worm-eaten, maniacal institution of the King's Bank to control us from the top downward and to shackle us from the cradle to the grave. End of quote from the Congressional Record. After McFadden was disposed of, the Jews continued their program of mass murder by instigating World War II, Korea, and Vietnam, bleeding America both literally and financially. Hundreds of books have been written by expert authorities detailing the tremendous activities of Jewish agents in the White House and Congress. Virtually all of these books have been suppressed. Occasionally, by miracle or accident, a true exposé will reach our library shelves, only to be quickly removed. In this overview of monetary history, we cannot provide much detail, but serious students have a virtually unlimited amount of information available primarily from private sources and publishers. However, we will take the time to show how the stage was set for World War II. The roots of the war go back to the end of World War I and the Versailles Peace Treaty. One of the favorite examples of fiat money or printing press inflation is the inflation of the German mark after World War I. They do so as either ignorant dupes or deceiving agents of the Jews. The World War ended in 1918. As of March 31st, 1919, just before the peace conference was called and the Versailles Treaty signed, the price levels of Germany were only 117% higher than they were before the World War began. This was a smaller price rise than had actually taken place in the United States. The public debt of Germany from the beginning of the World War until March 31st, 1919, had increased 130 billion marks. In terms of dollars, that would be roughly $30 billion. The United States had increased its own public debt to a similar amount. The German financial structure was not in any condition whatever to warrant the destruction of the currency, if that had not been the planned intention of the Jewish moneylenders. Under the terms of the Versailles Treaty, practically all of Germany's gold was taken away from her, together with 75% of her iron ore deposits and mines. All of her colonies were taken away, and about 25% of her other physical property. The terms of this treaty were diabolical. They were directed to destroy the real German people. From the time of the signing of the treaty in June 1919 until the beginning of 1922, the Jew money powers who were in control of the Reichsbank and the German government were manipulating to gain control of actual physical property in Germany. They went so far as to get the banking laws of Germany drastically changed so that they could borrow the unlimited amounts from the Reichsbank and purchase physical property with the knowledge that the loans could later be repaid with worthless currency. To give one some idea of the volume of currency that was turned out in Germany, one has only to note what happened to the price levels of Germany. Remember that during the war, the German price levels had not increased as much as they had in the United States. In 1920, the price level in Germany increased 1,500% over the pre-war level. In 1921, it reached 3,500% over the pre-war level. And by October 23rd, when the currency became worthless, it was 709 billion percent over the pre-war level. In other words, predatory Jews had printed private marks and forced them into the money system with the avowed purpose of destroying the money system of Germany. That meant the destruction of all insurance policies and mortgages owned by the real German people. The Jewish bankers had prepared themselves. They had obtained control of the physical properties and could later pay loans, many of which had been manipulated through the privately owned Reichsbank with worthless money. The inflation in Germany was misnamed. It was not a German inflation. It was a Jewish inflation perpetrated by the same creatures that murdered Christ. The inflation was not a government money inflation. It was an inflation of private Reichsbank notes. The officers of the Reichsbank, a Jewish-owned institution, were responsible for issuing money in sufficient volume to destroy the entire banking structure and make all of the money of Germany worthless. If you are wondering why the Germans accepted such devastating terms, it might have had something to do with the fact that among the dozens of Jew agents at the conference, Paul Warburg, vice chairman of the Federal Reserve, was advising the American delegation, while his brother, Max Warburg, who had been chief of the German Secret Service, sat across the table advising the German delegation. The Germans, not being stupid, knew to whom they had sold their homes, farms, and businesses for what quickly became bags of worthless marks. Consequently, Adolf Hitler appeared pointing a finger in the right direction. He became quite popular. Seeking to control Hitler, the Jews initially financed his rise to power. However, after achieving power, Hitler double-crossed the Jews and instituted a debt-free money system, which he had in mind from the beginning. This enabled Germany to go from being an impoverished nation to becoming the most powerful nation on earth in less than 5 years. Hitler had to be destroyed, and so he was. But in order to do so, it was necessary to involve the United States in the war before the Nazis, National Socialists in Germany, could destroy the Communists, International Socialists, in Russia. If our leaders had been acting in our best interests, we would have joined Hitler in building the foundation of the Kingdom of God here on earth.
We pray that your spiritual ears have received today's message, and that you are fed with strong meat relevant to solving the needs of our nation and Christian civilization everywhere. Herald of Truth is sponsored by Kingdom Identity Ministries through the financial support and prayers of listeners like you who love the truth of God's Word and want to see it broadcast throughout the land to awaken His people. If you would like a CD of today's message, tell us the date and station to which you are listening and send a donation to cover our cost plus help with radio time to Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas 72602. We would appreciate donations made by our international listeners to be in U.S. funds. For a free introductory packet of information, including our doctrinal statement of beliefs, plus lists of books and tapes to aid you in your study of biblical truth, write Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas 72602, USA. Or request this material by calling 870-741-1119. That's 870-741-1119. Visit our internet website by going to www.kingidentity.com. Type www.kingidentity.com. We invite you to listen regularly to Herald of Truth broadcast for more dynamic messages proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom at this same time and station.